It is August 14th, 1965. A little over 2 years since the day the sun went out. It is Will's birthday. He has gone around all day solemnly telling people that he has now lived a year for each inning in a baseball game. Jessie is unable to understand why this seems like a big deal to her brother, but it clearly does, and she decides that if Will wants to compare his life to a baseball game, that's perfectly okay. For quite a while, everything that happens at her little brother's birthday party is perfectly okay. Marvin Gaye is on the record player, true, but it is not the bad song, the dangerous song. "I wouldn't be doggone," Marvin sings, mock-threatening. "I be long gone, baby." Actually sort of a cute song, and the truth is that the day has been a lot better than okay, at least so far. It has been, in the words of Jessie's great-aunt Catherine, finer than fiddle music. Even her dad thinks so, although he wasn't very keen on the idea of coming back to Falmouth for Will's birthday when the idea was first suggested. Jessie had heard him say, "I guess it was a pretty good idea after all," to her mom, and that makes her feel good, because it was she, Jessie Mayhoot, daughter of Tom and Sally, sister of Will and Maddie, wife of nobody, who put the idea over. She's the reason they're here instead of inland at Sunset Trails. Sunset Trails is the family camp, although after 3 generations of haphazard family expansion, it is really big enough to be called a compound, on the north end of Darkscore Lake. This year they have broken their customary 9 weeks of seclusion there, because Will wants, just once, he has told his mother and father, speaking in the tones of a nobly suffering old grandee who knows he cannot cheat the reaper much longer, to have a birthday party with his rest-of-the-year friends as well as his family. Tom Mayhoot vetoes the idea at first. He is a stockbroker who divides his time between Portland and Boston, and for years he's told his family not to believe all that propaganda about how guys who go to work wearing ties and shirts with white collars spend their days goofing off, either hanging around the water cooler or dictating lunch invitations to pretty blondes from the Steno pool. "No hard-scrapple spud farmer in Aroostook County works any harder than I do," he frequently tells them. "Keeping up with the market isn't easy, and it isn't particularly glamorous either, no matter what you may have heard to the contrary." The truth is, none of them have heard anything to the contrary. All of them, his wife included, most likely, although Sally would never say so, think his job sounds duller than donkey shit, and only Maddie has the vaguest idea of what it is he does. Tom insists that he needs that time on the lake to recover from the stresses of his job, and that his son will have plenty of birthdays with his friends later on. Will is turning 9, after all, not 90. "Plus," Tom adds, "birthday parties with your pals really aren't much fun until you're old enough to have a keg or two." So Will's request to have his birthday at the family's year-round home on the coast would probably have been denied if not for Jessie's sudden, surprising support of the plan. And to Will it's plenty surprising. Jessie is 3 years older, and lots of times he's not sure she remembers she even has a brother. Following her initial soft-voiced suggestion that maybe it would be fun to come home, just for 2 or 3 days, of course, and have a lawn party with croquet and badminton and a barbecue and Japanese lanterns that would come on at dusk, Tom begins to warm to the idea. He is the sort of man who thinks of himself as a strong-willed son of a bitch, and is often thought of as a stubborn old goat by others. Whichever way you saw it, he has always been a tough man to move once he has set his feet and his jaw. His younger daughter is an exception to the general rule. Jessie has often found a way into her father's mind by some loophole or secret passage denied to the rest of the family. Sally believes it's just that their middle child is Tom's favorite, and Tom has fooled himself into believing that none of the others know. Maddie and Will see it in simpler terms. They believe that Jessie sucks up to their father, and that he in turn spoils her rotten. "If Daddy caught Jessie smoking," Will told his older sister the year before, after Maddie had been grounded for that very offense, "he'd probably buy her a lighter." Maddie laughed, agreed, and hugged her brother. Neither they nor her mother would have the slightest idea of the secret which lies between Tom Mayhoot and his younger daughter, like a heap of rotting meat. Jessie herself believes she is just going along with her baby brother's request, that she's sticking up for him, She has no idea, not on the surface of her mind anyway, how much she has come to hate Sunset Trails and how eager she is to get away. She has also come to hate the lake she once passionately loved, especially its faint, flat, mineral smell. By 1965, she can hardly bear to go swimming there, even on the hottest of days. She knows her mother thinks it's her shape. Jessie began to bud early, as Sally did herself, and at the age of 12, she has most of her woman's figure. But it's not her shape. She's gotten used to that, and knows that she's a long way from being a playboy pinup in either of her old, faded Janssen tank suits. No, it's not her breasts, not her hips, not her can. It's that smell. Whatever reasons and motives may be swirling around beneath, Will Mayhoot's request is finally approved by the Mayhoot family's head honcho. They made the trip back to the coast yesterday, leaving early enough for Sally, eagerly assisted by both daughters, to prepare for the party. And now it's August 14th, and August 14th is surely the apotheosis of summer in Maine, a day of faded blue denim skies and fat white clouds, all of it freshened by a salt-tangy breeze. Inland, and that includes the Lakes District, where Sunset Trails has stood on the shore of Darkscore Lake since Tom Mayhoot's grandfather built the original cabin in 1923. The woods and lakes and ponds and bogs lie sweltering under temperatures in the mid-90s, and humidity just below the saturation point. But here on the seacoast, it's only 80. The sea breeze is an extra bonus, rendering the humidity negligible and sweeping away the mosquitoes and the sandflies. The lawn is filled with children, mostly Will's friends, but girls who chum with Maddie and Jessie as well. And for once, mirabile dictu, they all seem to be getting along. There hasn't been a single argument, and around 5 o'clock, as Tom raises the first martini of the day to his lips, he glances at Jessie, who is standing nearby with her croquet mallet propped on her shoulder like a sentry's rifle, and who is clearly within earshot of what sounds like a casual husband and wife conversation, but which may actually be a shrewd bank-shot compliment aimed at his daughter, then back at his wife. "I guess it was actually a pretty good idea, after all," he says. "Better than good," Jessie thinks. "Absolutely great and totally monster, if you want to know the truth." Even that isn't what she really means, really thinks. But it would be dangerous to say the rest out loud. It would tempt the gods. What she really thinks is that the day is flawless, a sweet and perfect peach of a day. Even the song blasting out of Maddie's portable record player, which Jessie's big sister has cheerfully carted out to the patio for this occasion, although it is ordinarily the great untouchable icon, is okay. Jessie is never really going to like Marvin Gaye, no more than she is ever going to like that faint mineral smell which rises from the lake on hot summer afternoons. But this song is okay. "I'll be doggone if you ain't a pretty thing, baby." Silly, but not dangerous. It is August 14th, 1965, a day that was, a day that still is, in the mind of a dreaming woman handcuffed to a bed, in a house on the shore of a lake 40 miles south of Darkscore, but with the same mineral smell, that nasty evocative smell, on hot, still summer days. And although the 12-year-old girl she was doesn't see Will creeping up behind her as she bends over to address her croquet ball, turning her bottom into a target simply too tempting for a boy who has only lived 1 year for each inning in a baseball game to ignore, part of her mind knows he is there, and that this is the seam where the dream has been basted to the nightmare. She lines up her shot, concentrating on the wicket 6 feet away. A hard shot, but not an impossible one. And if she drives the ball through, she may well catch Carolyn after all. That would be nice, because Carolyn almost always wins at croquet. Then just as she draws her mallet back, the music coming from the record player changes. "Oh, listen, everybody," Marvin Gaye sings, sounding a lot more than just mock-threatening to Jessie this time. "Especially you girls." Chills of goose flesh run up Jessie's tanned arms. Is it right to be left alone when the one you love is never home? I love too hard, my friends sometimes say. Her fingers go numb, and she loses any sense of the mallet in her hands. Her wrists are tingling, as if bound by... Stocks. Goody's in the stocks. Come and see Goody in the stocks. Come and laugh at Goody in the stocks. Unseen clamps, and her heart is suddenly full of dismay. It is the other song, the wrong song, the bad song. But I believe, that a woman should be loved this way. She looks up at the little group of girls waiting for her to make her shot, and sees that Carolyn is gone. Standing there in her place is Nora Callaghan. Her hair is in braids. There's a dab of white zinc on the tip of her nose. She's wearing Carolyn's yellow sneakers and Carolyn's locket, the one with a tiny picture of Paul McCartney inside it. But those are Nora's green eyes, and they are looking at her with a deep, adult compassion. Jesse suddenly remembers that Will, undoubtedly egged on by his buddies, who are as jazzed up on Cokes and German chocolate cake as Will himself, is creeping up behind her, that he's preparing to goose her. She will overreact wildly when he does, swinging around and punching him in the mouth, perhaps not spoiling the party completely, but certainly putting a ding in its sweet perfection. She tries to let go of the mallet, wanting to straighten and turn around before any of this can happen. She wants to change the past, but the past is heavy. Trying to do that, she discovers, is like trying to pick up the house by one corner so you can look under it for things that have been lost, or forgotten, or hidden. Behind her, someone has cranked the volume on Maddie's little record player, and that terrible song blares louder than ever, triumphant and glittery and sadistic. It hurts me so inside, to be treated so unkind. Somebody, somewhere, tell her it ain't fair. She tries again to get rid of the mallet, to throw it away, but she can't do it. It's as if someone has handcuffed her to it. Nora, she cries. Nora, you have to help me. Stop him. It was at this point in the dream that Jesse moaned for the first time, momentarily startling the dog back from Gerald's body. Nora shakes her head slowly and gravely. I can't help you, Jesse. You're on your own. We all are. I generally don't tell my patients that, but I think in your case it's best to be honest. You don't understand. I can't go through this again. I can't. Oh, don't be so silly, Nora says, suddenly impatient. She begins to turn away, as if she can no longer bear the sight of Jesse's upturned, frantic face. You will not die. It's not poison. Jesse looks around wildly, although she remains unable to straighten up, to stop presenting that tempting target to her impending brother, and sees that her friend Tammy Ho is gone. Standing there in Tammy's white shorts and yellow halter is Ruth Neary. She's holding Tammy's red-striped croquet mallet in one hand and a Marlboro in the other. Her mouth is hooked up at the corners in her usual sardonic grin, but her eyes are grave and full of sorrow. Ruth, help me! Jesse shouts. You have to help me! Ruth takes a big drag on her cigarette and grinds it into the grass with one of Tammy Ho's cork-soled sandals. Jeepers, creepers, Tootsie. He's going to goose you, not stick a cattle prod up your ass. You know that as well as I do. You've been through all this before. So what's the big deal? It isn't just a goose. It isn't, and you know it. The old hooty-owl hooty-hoos to the goose, Ruth says. What? What does that mean? It means how can I know anything about anything? Ruth shoots back. There is anger on the surface of her voice, deep hurt beneath. You wouldn't tell me. You wouldn't tell anybody. You ran away. You ran like a rabbit that sees the shadow of some old hooty owl on the grass. I couldn't tell! Jessie shrieks. Now she can see a shadow on the grass beside her. as if Ruth's words have conjured it up. It is not the shadow of an owl, however. It is the shadow of her brother. She can hear the stifled giggles of his friends, knows he is reaching out to do it, and still she cannot even straighten up, let alone move away. She is helpless to change what is going to happen, and she understands that this is the very essence of both nightmare and tragedy. Not fear, but helplessness. I couldn't! She shrieks at Ruth again. I couldn't, not ever! It would have killed my mom or destroyed the family or both! He said! Daddy said! I hate to be the one to send you this particular news flash, Tootsie Wootsie, but your dear old dad will have been dead 12 years come December. Also, can't we dispense with at least a little of this melodrama? It's not as if he hung you from the clothesline by the nipples and then set your twat on fire, you know. But she doesn't want to hear this. Doesn't want to consider, even in a dream, any reappraisal of her buried past. Once the dominoes start to fall, who knows where it will all end? So she blocks her ears to what Ruth is saying and continues to fix her old college roommate with that deep, pleading stare that so often caused Ruth, whose tough cookie veneer was never more than frosting deep anyway, to laugh and give in, to do whatever it was Jesse wanted her to do. Ruth, you have to help me. You have to. But this time the pleading stare doesn't work. I don't think so, Toots. The sorority Susies are all gone. The time for shutting up is over. Running away is out of the question. And waking up is not an option. This is the mystery train, Jesse. You're the pussycat, I'm the owl. Here we go. All aboard. Fasten your seatbelt and fasten it tight. This is an e-ticket ride. No! But now, to Jesse's horror, the day begins to darken. It could just be the sun going behind a cloud, but she knows it isn't. The sun is going out. Soon the stars will shine in a summer afternoon sky, and the old hooty owl will hooty-hoo to the dove. The time of the eclipse has come. No! She screams again. That was 2 years ago! You're wrong on that one, Toots, Ruth Neary says. For you, it never ended. For you, the sun never came back out. She opens her mouth to deny that, to tell Ruth she's as guilty of wild overdramatization as Nora, who kept shoving her toward doors she didn't want to open, who kept assuring her that the present can be improved by examining the past, as if one could improve the taste of today's dinner by slathering it with the maggoty remains of yesterday's. She wants to tell Ruth, as she told Nora on the day she walked out of Nora's office for good, that there is a big difference between living with something and being kept prisoner by it. Don't you two goofs understand that the cult of the self is just another cult? She wants to say. But before she can do more than open her mouth, the invasion comes. A hand between her slightly spread legs, the thumb shoving rudely at the cleft of her buttocks, the fingers pressed against the material of her shorts just above her vagina. And it is not her brother's innocent little hand this time. The hand between her legs is much bigger than Will's and not a bit innocent. The bad song is on the radio. The stars are out at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And this, you will not die, it's not poison, is how big people goose each other. She whirls, expecting to see her father. He did something like this to her during the eclipse, a thing she supposes the whining cult of selfers that live in the pastures like Ruth and Nora would call child abuse. Whatever it was, it will be him, she's sure of that much, and she is afraid she will exact a terrible punishment for the thing he did, no matter how serious or trivial that thing was. She will raise the croquet mallet and drive it into his face, smashing his nose and knocking out his teeth. And when he falls down on the grass, the dogs will come and eat him up. Except it isn't Tom Mayhoot standing there, It's Gerald. He's naked. The penis of an attorney pokes out at her from below the soft pink bowl of his belly. He has a set of Krieg police handcuffs in each hand. He holds them out to her in the weird afternoon darkness. Unnatural starlight gleams on the cocked jaws, which are stamped M17, because his source could not provide him with any F-23s. "Come on, Jess," he says, grinning. "It isn't as though you don't know the score. Besides, you liked it. That first time you came so hard you almost blew up. I don't mind telling you that was the best piece of ass I ever had in my life. So good I sometimes dream about it. And you know why it was so good? Because you didn't have to take any of the responsibility. Almost all women like it better when the man takes over completely. It's a proven fact of female psychology. Did you come when your father molested you, Jesse? I bet you did. I bet you came so hard you almost blew up. The cult of the selfers may want to argue about these things, but we know the truth, don't we? Some women can say they want it, but some need a man to tell them they want it. You're one of the latter. But that's okay, Jesse. That's what the cuffs are for. Only they were never really handcuffs at all. They're bracelets of love. So put them on, sweetheart. Put them on." She backs up, shaking her head, not knowing if she wants to laugh or cry. The subject itself is new, but the rhetoric is all too familiar. "The lawyer's tricks don't work on me, Gerald. I've been married to one too long. What we both know is that the business with the handcuffs was never about me at all. It was about you. About waking up your old booze-stunned John Thomas a little, to be blunt. So you can just save your fucked-up version of female psychology, okay?" Gerald is smiling in a knowing, disconcerted way. "Good try, babe. It doesn't wash, but it was still a damn good shot. The best defense is a good offense, right? I think I taught you that. Never mind, though. Right now, you've got a choice to make. Either put the bracelets on or swing that mallet and kill me again." She looks around and realizes with dawning panic and dismay that everyone at Will's party is watching her confrontation with this naked, except for his glasses, that is, overweight, sexually aroused man. And it's not just her family and her childhood friends, either. Mrs. Henderson, who will be her freshman advisor at college, is standing by the punch bowl. Bobby Hagen, who will take her to the senior prom and fuck her afterwards in the back seat of his father's Oldsmobile 88, is standing on the patio next to the blonde girl from the Newworth Parsonage, the one whose parents had loved her but idolized her brother. Barry, Jesse thinks. She's Olivia, and her brother's Barry. The blonde girl is listening to Bobby Hagen but looking at Jesse, her face calm but somehow haggard. She is wearing a sweatshirt which shows R. Crumb's Mr. Natural hurrying down a city street. The words in the balloon coming out of Mr. Natural's mouth say, "Vice is nice, but incest is best." Behind Olivia, Kendall Wilson, who will hire Jesse for her first teaching job, is cutting a piece of chocolate birthday cake for Mrs. Page, her childhood piano teacher. Mrs. Page is looking remarkably lively for a woman who died of a stroke 2 years ago while picking apples at Corritz Orchards in Alfred. Jesse thinks, "This isn't like dreaming. It's like drowning. Everyone I've ever known seems to be standing here under this weird starlit afternoon sky, watching my naked husband try to put me in handcuffs, while Marvin Gaye sings, 'Can I Get a Witness?' If there's any comfort to be had, it's this. Things can't possibly get any worse." Then they do. Mrs. Wirtz, her first grade teacher, starts to laugh. Old Mr. Cobb, their gardener until he retired in 1964, laughs with her. Maddie joins in, and Ruth, and Olivia of the scarred breasts. Kendall Wilson and Bobby Hagen are bent almost double, and they're clapping each other on the back like men who have heard the granddaddy of all dirty jokes in the local barber shop. Perhaps the one whose punchline is, "A life support system for a cunt." Jessie looks down at herself and sees that now she is naked too. Written across her breasts in a shade of lipstick known as Peppermint Yum Yum are three damning words, "Daddy's little girl." "I have to wake up," she thinks. "I'll die of shame if I don't." But she doesn't, at least not right away. She looks up and sees that Gerald's knowing, disconcerting smile has turned into a gaping wound. Suddenly the stray dog's blood-soaked snout pokes out between his teeth. The dog is also grinning, and the head that comes shoving out between its fangs, like the onset of some obscene birth, belongs to her father. His eyes, always a bright blue, are now gray and haggard above his grin. They are Olivia's eyes, she realizes, and then she realizes something else as well. The flat mineral smell of lake water, so bland and yet so horrible, is everywhere. "I love too hard," my friends sometimes say, her father sings from inside the mouth of the dog, which is inside the mouth of the husband. "But I believe, that a woman should be loved that way." She casts the mallet aside and runs, screaming. As she passes the horrible creature with its bizarre chain of nested heads, Gerald snaps one of the handcuffs around her wrist. "Got you," he yells triumphantly. "Got you, me proud beauty." At first, she thinks the eclipse must not have been total yet after all, because the day has begun to grow still darker. Then it occurs to her that she is probably fainting. This thought is accompanied by feelings of deep relief and gratitude. "Don't be silly, Jess. You can't faint in a dream." But she thinks she may be doing just that. And in the end, it doesn't matter much whether it is a faint or only a deeper cave of sleep toward which she is fleeing, like the survivor of some cataclysm. What matters is that she is finally escaping the dream which has assaulted her in a much more fundamental way than her father's act on the deck that day. She is finally escaping, and gratitude seems like a beautifully normal response to these circumstances. She has almost made it into that comforting cave of darkness when a sound intrudes. A splintery, ugly sound like a loud spasm of coughing. She tries to flee the sound and finds she cannot. It has her like a hook, and like a hook it begins to pull her up toward the vast but fragile silver sky that separates sleep from consciousness.